Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Here and Now. Supreme Court nominee Harriet Myers continues to pay courtesy calls to senators on Capitol Hill today, and her nomination continues to divide conservatives. Groups like Progress for America are promoting her nomination, while abortion opponents from Operation Rescue are actively campaigning to have it withdrawn. And Dr. James Dobson of the group Focus on the Family was one of several conservative leaders who got a White House call ahead of Monday's nomination. He says, "Some of what I know, I'm not at liberty to talk about," and he also said he would support the nomination because of what he heard and because of Harriet Myers' religious faith. So Dobson was swayed, but what about others? Joining us on the line is Patrick Buchanan, prominent conservative, former presidential candidate, and chair of the group The American Cause. Pat, welcome.
How are you, Robin?
I'm fine, and you have written that Harriet Myers may be a gracious lady, but her qualifications are non-existent. You wrote that a couple days ago. Have you heard anything in the last few days to change your mind?
Nothing whatsoever. Dr. Dobson said she's a fine Christian lady, and I have no doubt of that. And she's a competent and very able lawyer. I have no doubt of that. But there is nothing that remotely qualifies her to sit on the United States Supreme Court, where the great moral and cultural and social decisions of our era are made consistent or inconsistent with the Constitution of the United States. The study of the Constitution and the great issues that come before it is really a specialty, and you don't get that practicing corporate law or in the White House counsel's office.
I'm wondering, did anyone from the White House try to sway you or hold your feet to the fire in any way?
No, I have not gotten a call from the White House. I'm sure that the conservatives who have spoken up, the minority that have, one of the reasons the president went into the Rose Garden to mount a defense of Harriet Myers yesterday.
Well, more is becoming known about Harriet Myers. She was once a Democrat. When she was running for the Dallas City Council in 1989, she met with gay activists and told them that she supported gay rights, but not the repeal of the Texas sodomy law. A political aide named Lorelei Bartos said that she believes that Harriet Myers is on the extreme end of the anti-choice movement. These kinds of political issues, are these not as important to you as you said, the fact that she's not a constitutional scholar?
Well, look, they would certainly be if I were voting for Harriet Myers for the Congress of the United States. But these battles in the United States Supreme Court, they are tough. They require a philosophical depth. They require a knowledge of history, of constitutional conflicts. And I don't see that in Harriet Myers yet.
President Bush says he cannot have a litmus test. So what about that comment from him?
Well, the Democratic Party on the Hill, many of them presumably Catholics, say that they do have a litmus test, that you have to support Roe v. Wade, and they will not vote for any nominee who would oppose Roe v. Wade. Now, I agree the president should not ask the question of his nominee if they're going to have to deal with it, how will you vote on this? Because you don't know what form it's going to come to the Supreme Court. But I think that what the president ought to say, I am pro-life, and thus I would like to see Roe v. Wade overturned. And I believe these decisions ought to be made by states and communities and by the federal Congress, not by judges.
Patrick Buchanan, how bad is this disagreement for the Republican Party? You write some pretty tough things in a recent column that President Bush might have been too influential, couldn't take the heat from his wife, I think was your phrase, that he rewarded a crony, that he ran from a fight with the Senate. How much is this disagreement going to hurt the party?
The conservative movement is torn apart over this. I do believe, and I'm given to understand, that Mr. Rove made a lot of phone calls, and they've convinced folks that, look, she's solid, trust us on this. But many of us believe that the president did not vet this well. He did. He's asked us to take this on faith, and that's not acceptable. But I think this is really a time when conservatives ought to stand on principle and conviction and on the principle of excellence as opposed to, quote, diversity, and say, Mr. President, you made a mistake and you should withdraw this nomination.
You write that Karl Rove may have been distracted by the Valerie Plame investigation. Do you think Karl Rove's days are numbered?
Well, all our days are numbered.
Yes, that's true. But as advisor to President Bush.
I think if Karl Rove survives the Valerie Plame thing, my guess is he will stay on until after the 2006 election to move on.
Do you think he can survive this, Harriet Myers?
Oh, I think this is the decision of the President of the United States. And let me talk again to your question, which I might have not hit directly. George W. Bush listened to Harry Reid on this and not the people who supported him and who worked for him. And he went with the advice of people who have opposed him. He did duck a fight. People talk about political capital. You put political capital in the bank by standing up and fighting for what you believe in.
Patrick Buchanan, syndicated columnist, former presidential candidate, chair of the group The American Cause, and against the nomination of Harriet Myers to the Supreme Court. Patrick, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
In Iraq, a bomb blast today at a Shiite mosque south of Baghdad has reportedly killed 10 and wounded 40. Yesterday, the Pentagon announced the deaths of 4 soldiers and 1 Marine in separate incidents in Iraq. Nate Fick is closely watching the death tally there. As a classics major at Dartmouth, he studied the history of war. As a Marine fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq, he confronted the reality of it. Nate signed up with the Marines in 1999 at a time when the country was talking about a peace dividend. Then came 9/11. He was sent to Afghanistan as a platoon commander and then to Iraq, where he was captain of a Marine reconnaissance unit that was profiled by Rolling Stone writer Evan Wright in his book, Generation Kill. Nate left the military in June of 2003 and then decided to write his own book, not to make a point, he says, but to make sense of a time and place that continues to haunt him. And Nate Fick joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
But first, I want to start at the beginning. You studied classics in college at Dartmouth. Your grandfather had fought in World War II, as many of our grandfathers and fathers had. But you didn't. You wouldn't say you came from a military family. So why did you join?
I certainly didn't come from a military family. As a matter of fact, I had a hard time explaining my choice to my family. Mm. But as I got closer and closer to college graduation, this was the height of the tech boom in the late 90s, and my classmates were going to Silicon Valley and Wall Street or on to graduate school. And at some visceral level, it just didn't appeal to me. I wanted something public service oriented, something outdoors, adventure, leadership, all the things that I think a lot of young people are looking for.
Which you could have been a Boy Scout leader.
Actually, you know, my choice really came down to the Marine Corps, the Peace Corps. And my friends who are Peace Corps volunteers cringe when I say this, but I think that in some ways, the two organizations do similar things to young people.
Well, that's interesting. Tell us more about that, because, you know, you've had to respond to people who have said, 1999, at Dartmouth, you joined the military, you know, and people who even now are debating military recruiting on campus, saying, you know, it militarizes the schools. What's your response to that?
One of my motivations to join came from a talk I heard given by Tom Ricks, who was then the Wall Street Journal's Pentagon correspondent, and he was advocating for the presence of ROTC on college campuses. And he took a question after his talk from a young professor who said, how can you support the presence of ROTC here? It will do just what you said, militarize our campus and threaten our culture of tolerance. And he looked at her and he said, no, you're wrong. What it will do is liberalize the military. And that's not politically liberalize. That's diversify the military and ensure that people from all backgrounds and all walks of life are in the U.S. military.
Mm-hmm. Well, we want to find out if you felt that you might have accomplished that in some small way. But before that, let's just briefly touch on your experience in Iraq. There's a passage in your book that seems pretty foreshadowing. It comes weeks after Baghdad is liberated. Jubilant crowds of Iraqis are now making their way back to the city. You're sitting and eating lunch with your platoon and trying to project what's next at that time, just after Baghdad's liberated. Can you read that for us?
I'd be happy to. I was struck time and again by the amount of foresight that the Marines on the ground had. And it's important when I read this passage to remember that, as you say, it was lived just a few weeks after Baghdad fell, and it was written down 2 years ago. Mm. I mean, just the production process of the book. So, I mean, it almost sounds revisionist, like we're, you know, trying to make it sound more prescient than it really was.
Right.
But, I mean, this is actually as it was inscribed 2 years ago.
Okay.
So, sir, what do you think is going to happen? Jax asked the question, but he spoke for the others, and all eyes settled on me. Sitting around and talking with the platoon was my favorite pastime in Iraq. Sometimes I'd come up with new topics just because I didn't want the conversations to end. It's too soon to say. But I'll tell you what I hope will happen, I said. I hope we'll stop moving around and be assigned a sector. I hope we'll patrol in that sector day after day. These people don't give a f*** about democracy right now. They need clean water. They need to know they won't get shot in the middle of the night. People put their money on the horse that looks like a winner. We need to convince them that we're the winner. But what are the odds of that happening, sir? Corporal Chaffin asked, as he scrubbed a rifle balanced on his knees. I bet we keep moving around, making promises we can't keep, and then the normal people will start to see us as occupiers instead of liberators. Chaffin was fair-skinned with reddish hair. His complexion darkened as he spoke. Pretty soon, no one will want us here, and then the f***ing liberals at home will start to bitch, and pretty soon we'll be back in Vietnam. Only instead of reading about it in a book, we'll be living it. I guess I'm more optimistic than that, I answered. This isn't Vietnam. The guys we're fighting have no superpower support, no sanctuary next door. Sir, I'm going to pull your punk card, Aspera interrupted. With all due respect, I think you're wrong. He leaned close and pointed his thin cigar. Guerrilla wars aren't fought from sanctuaries with support from sugar mama countries. That's political scientist bull****. They're fought from the mind. He tapped his temple with his cigar. If these people don't want for themselves what we want for them, then this will be Vietnam. We'll get our pride and our credibility involved, and then we'll keep throwing money and men down the pit long after everybody else knows we're f***ed. We'll leave, and Iraq will be even worse than the sh**hole it was a month ago when we kicked down the door.
Putting the comparisons to Vietnam aside, Aspera especially seems awfully right on. And your fears reflect what we've heard from other soldiers, that they felt that they were moved around all the time fighting the insurgency and never had a chance to really relate with one community in one sector and do the things they needed, like turn on the lights. Where do we go from here, in your opinion?
We, as American citizens, are given a false choice in Iraq. It's a straw man that's put up for us. And the choices are between staying the course, which is the administration's current rhetoric, or the Cindy Sheehan alternative, which is precipitous withdrawal. And I think that both are irresponsible.
What's the third way?
Well, let's talk about historical parallels very quickly. The administration did it with Hurricane Katrina recently. It's not an apology. It's an acknowledgement of federal responsibility for something that didn't go right. And what it does then is open the door for critical self-evaluation. Historically, one of my favorite military anecdotes in history is from World War II, when General Eisenhower, who was commanding the D-Day invasion in 1944, actually had a speech written in which he acknowledged responsibility in case the invasion failed. You can see the original, and he actually changed the wording in the speech. The speech he would have delivered says, the responsibility for this is mine, and he crossed it out and made it even stronger and said, I take full responsibility for this failure. And so there is a third way that requires good, rigorous, analytical thinking, integrating some historical lessons, and it's all predicated on the willingness at the very top in our political and military establishments to say, hey, we've made a mistake. It's not about the blame game that we hear so much about now. It's just about clearing the way for the senior uniformed leadership to break ranks.
Nate Fick, former Marine captain in Iraq, author of the book One Bullet Away, will have more of his thoughts when we come back. You are listening to Here and Now. And now we've been talking with Nathaniel Fick, former Marine captain, author of the book One Bullet Away, The Making of a Marine Captain, and now a Harvard grad student. And Nate, we were just talking about finding a third way to fight the war in Iraq, something different from the administration's plans to stay the course or the critics' calls to bring them home. And it sounds like a good idea, but what would the third way, you know, look like, feel like on the ground?
Conventional armies have been fighting counterinsurgency warfare for 3,000 years. The playbook has been written. There's no need to reinvent this wheel. And what really angers me in Iraq right now is when I talk to friends who are coming back today or who are there today, and they're encountering the same things I encountered 2 years ago because the same mistakes are still being made.
Meaning what?
My platoon got in firefights frequently with Syrian jihadists who would cross the border intent on killing Americans. And still today, soldiers and Marines are fighting Syrians in Iraq. Some of the more powerful roadside bombs that have been used recently, destroying whole armored vehicles and killing Americans 10 or 14 at a time, are thought to have come in from Iran. So one tactical fix is to seal those borders. This isn't Vietnam. It's not a jungle border. There aren't physical limitations to our ability to do that. It's a matter of willpower and putting, allocating the manpower and the resources to do it. Mm. I think that there's something really at the root of this, and that is a philosophical shift. From the beginning in Iraq, our focus from presidential rhetoric all the way down to tactics on the ground has been on killing insurgents. It's been very offensive from, taking the fight there so we don't
have it here. Fight,
right, exactly. Or Osama bin Laden dead or alive, or bring him on. I mean, that creates a culture of the offense. And it's predicated on the idea that the supply of insurgents is finite. And I think that's a false premise. Occupation naturally creates resentment. And so we create insurgents from within. So I'd like to see a philosophical shift away from that kill insurgents mentality to an effort to improve life for the average Iraqi citizen. I didn't see many Iraqi fanatics in Iraq. I saw a lot of normal families that you see anywhere in the States who want the same things we want, to be able to walk around their neighborhoods at night and not get shot, to have electricity 24 hours a day, clean water, food.
Yeah, but Nate Fick, don't there have to be soldiers with their, facing outward in case of incoming insurgents while other soldiers help string up electricity? I mean, what else has to happen? Are you talking about more troops in Iraq?
I'm not saying that the military no longer has a role, but the military's preeminent role was in toppling the Hussein regime. The military now is a necessary but not sufficient condition. That basic security still has to be achieved. And there will still be offensive operations in Iraq, without doubt. But there has to be something else, too. Mm-hmm. And we've done a very poor job of creating the impression, both in the United States and in Iraq, that this is winnable, and it's winnable by us. People are pragmatic. They're going to put their money on the winning horse. And the United States has not convinced the Iraqis, and nor, I think, have we convinced many Americans right. That we are, in fact, the winning horse.
Nate Fick is a former Marine captain, served in Iraq and Afghanistan, brought 65 men there and 65 men home.
Yes.
Platoon leader. He's written a book about his experience called One Bullet Away, and he's got some passionate ideas about what needs to happen now in Iraq. Do soldiers want this? I mean, we've spoken to soldiers who have said, I'm not there to string up lights. I'm not there to bring water. I'm a soldier. I fight a war.
I think that they're wrong, quite frankly. And when I went through my training, my Marine training back in the late 90s, that was the prevailing attitude. The attitude was a platoon that can fight an armored, mechanized, tank-equipped enemy, the classic military confrontation. If you can do that, then surely you can paint a school or string up lights or hand out food.
Do you think it's too late for change? I mean, people are already saying that Iraq is already spiraling into civil war.
Within Iraq, I don't know. The constitutional referendum is coming up, and now there's talk of the Shia and the Kurds rigging it, of trying to exclude the Sunnis from the process. And we may reach a time when the United States has to say, look, we deposed the Hussein regime, we poured $200 billion and 2,000 lives into this country, and now it's up to you, the Iraqis, to make the future that you want for yourself.
What would you say to people who would look at you and say, you don't look like a soldier. You look like a Harvard guy.
I guess I'd take offense at that. That question to me is indicative of a broader problem in our society, that it's very easy to put the military in a box and it's over there. It's always them. It's never us. I passionately believe that the military has to be us. It can never be them. It has to be broadly representative of Americans.
But some people would say it has become, an us and them. And I guess, last thought, you've said you oppose the draft. But as you know, there are recruitment shortfalls. So if you were to give a speech, and you might, to the graduating class at Dartmouth, what would you say?
I would tell them that their country needs them, that it's not about an administration or a president or a policy. Yet they have to take a much longer view. And when you join the military, you swear an oath to the Constitution, and you will uphold the lawful orders of a democratically elected government. It's public service in the purest sense. I served under the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, and the men I served with did too. And nobody would ever think twice of disobeying the order of a legally elected American government. I was in Turkey in 1997 for a coup that toppled the government there. I think it's worth remembering there are a lot of tanks within a day's drive of Washington, and the apolitical tradition of the U.S. military is sacred, and it's worth preserving.
That's Nate Fick. He's a former Marine captain who fought in Afghanistan and Iraq, also author of the book One Bullet Away, The Making of a Marine Officer. Nate's recon platoon returned to Iraq 1 week ago for its fourth combat tour since 9/11. And this note about Iraq. President Bush met today with top military leaders. Speaking at the White House, he warned that insurgents may increase their attacks in the next few days in advance of a constitutional referendum scheduled for October 15th.
We fully understand they tend to disrupt the constitutional process, or will try to do so, as well as stop the progress of democracy. Part of the way the Pentagon and the folks on the ground are going to deal with it is to stay on the offense.
And earlier today, Iraqi leaders announced they'd dropped proposed rule changes that would have made it impossible for Sunnis to reject the Constitution. Those rules had been strongly criticized by the United Nations and the U.S. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. Funding for Here and Now. Now, with his city brought to its knees, the mayor of New Orleans is now faced with a catch-22. How can he convince people to come home when they no longer have a job? Most businesses have yet to reopen, and yesterday Mayor Ray Nagin announced he's firing 3,000 non-essential city employees. The mayor says the layoffs will save the city up to $8 million a month. Well, joining us in line to talk about the economic woes of New Orleans is Kathy Finn, editor of the online publication BizNewOrleans.com. Kathy, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And can you help us understand something first? We know that the city has received about $202 million from FEMA, but we're now learning that under federal law, that money can only go towards things like overtime, but not salaries?
I believe that's correct. And I think that was in response to a change that was made after hurricanes hit the south coast of Florida several years ago and badly battered that area. I think under President Clinton, in fact, a change was made in the law that allowed FEMA only to pay the overtime wages versus the regular time that would ordinarily be needed in a situation like this.
Now, we understand that legislators in Washington are trying to change it back again, but it will come way too late for these city employees. Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco warned that local governments are on the verge of collapse if the law doesn't change sooner. How dire is the financial situation?
Well, I think it's dire, definitely, and it's interesting that the governor's announcement of that situation came just a day before the mayor of New Orleans announced the 3,000 layoffs. They're both in the same situation, and they recognize the situation being that for the short term, we're in a very bad situation. There's a lot of proposals floating around now for longer term fixes, tax breaks down the line, and things like that, and housing assistance for rebuilding in New Orleans and lots of other areas hit badly by the hurricanes. But what the federal government seems to be ignoring or not really be aware of at the moment is the dire need for short-term assistance.
Right, because when you think about it, I mean, it makes sense. Stores aren't selling things, people aren't getting paychecks. There's no sales tax base, I would think. There's no taxes coming out of paychecks.
That's correct. And what New Orleans is up against right now is the same thing some of the smaller towns around Louisiana are up against, and that's the lack of a tax base. I mean, most of the people, the sales taxes aren't coming in because no one's there spending. Much of the population of New Orleans remains still outside of New Orleans because they all evacuated somewhere else.
They're not spending their money in New Orleans, certainly.
Correct. And even some of the businesses that have been able to get their doors open again and maybe have power and water and basic services, they're ready to do business, but the fact is their customers aren't there.
We've focused on different areas of the city that have been devastated by this, but you mentioned there's a part of the town that hasn't been talked about much, but it did provide a huge economic base. Which is that?
Well, that's an area we call Lakeview, and it's a very large section of the city. You don't hear a great deal about it. There's been a lot more attention paid, really, to the Ninth Ward, for instance, and St. Bernard Parish, just downriver from New Orleans, and with good reason. Those places were devastated and really struck very hard. The interesting thing, I think, about Lakeview is that it's a really a bastion of the middle class, and a very large bastion of the middle class. And it's an area of the city that is home to many younger families, families with children, some of the best schools in the city, above average income, and this is a really, really important area for the tax base of New Orleans. That area was hit very, very hard, almost as hard as St. Bernard or Ninth Ward. So much of the housing there has just been destroyed. It was under anywhere from 3 feet to 15 feet of water, and the water sat there for 2.5 weeks. So you can imagine the condition of those homes.
And so there's not a lot of revenue money coming out of that neighborhood because the people aren't there. They're not spending it. You know, when you think of infrastructure of a city, one of the most basic things you think of is a bank. And we're hearing about banks in New Orleans that are having no checks deposited, people withdrawing their entire savings, maxing out on credit cards, not paying them back. And some of these are smaller banks. Are banks failing in New Orleans?
I think it's far too soon to say that banks are failing in New Orleans. I think that they're going to be up against some very major problems, probably not too far down the line, especially the smaller ones. Obviously, there's the problem of foreclosures, if that becomes necessary, on mortgages that go unpaid, people who walk away from their homes. There will be, I think we're getting very close to a rash of business bankruptcies, and that's the thing that's really going to tell the next tale, the next chapter in this whole disaster, I'm afraid, is that we're going to see a lot of small businesses going belly up because they can't afford to stay in business. You know, since the hurricane, we're about 5 weeks away from the hurricane now. Some of these businesses are up against their third round of payroll, excuse me, and are having to meet payroll without a revenue stream. That's going to cause bankruptcies, and I think we're very close to seeing a rash of those. So again, what's really needed here is something that these businesses have not been able to get, and that's very short-term assistance in meeting payroll.
And when businesses go out of business, it's the local people who work there, if they're small local businesses, so they again lose jobs, and you get back in that vicious cycle. Kathy, you know, again, you edit an online publication, bizneworleans.com, and sometimes it's easier to work online in a situation like this, but what are you having to do?
Well, actually, the headquarters of bizneworleans.com right now is a little fishing camp on a river about 2 hours northwest of New Orleans. This is where my husband and I evacuated. It's near his hometown. And we fortunately were able to find a friend who had this little place, and we could be here. It's only a couple of rooms and a porch, but honestly, to us, it's a palace.
But I understand. I mean, you know, business like yours, I'm wondering, what about all the publications that rely on advertising and, you know, the kinds of things that keep a city running?
I think everyone who is involved with an enterprise like that right now is up against the wall. My own company has been very seriously affected. We have a lot of publications. We were the largest locally owned publisher in New Orleans, a number of publications and a couple of radio stations. Our staff has certainly felt the pain, and we've had layoffs at our company. Most of the people have relocated somewhere else, at least temporarily. We have a temporary office near Baton Rouge right now. So we're just struggling, as all the other publications I know in the city are struggling right now, to try to hold it together long enough to get some kind of a base back.
Right. Well, but we understand there are rays of hope. We want to mention the Winn-Dixie reopened in the East Bank. What does that do for people when, you know, they see a store open?
Well, I think it's very important, certainly in the uptown area of New Orleans especially. That's where this store opened. Winn-Dixie is the largest grocer operating in the metropolitan area right now, and they have the largest base of business. And this is the first store that they opened on the East Bank of New Orleans. And that's very important to the people who have been waiting in the uptown area for basic services.
But again, if people start losing their jobs and stop getting paychecks, they won't have the money to spend it at the Winn-Dixie. And again, it just starts to cycle around. Kathy Finn is editor of the online publication bizneworleans.com. She's speaking to us from the fishing camp where they're now publishing. Kathy, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
You're listening to Here and Now. Well, as we heard, New Orleans is laying off some 3,000 city workers as it tries to recover and rebuild after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. Meantime, the reconstruction effort is posing challenges to organized labor. The federal government has temporarily suspended sanctioning employers who hire undocumented workers. And employers in the region are also being allowed to pay lower wages. These developments come as organized labor reorganizes. Seven unions, led by the Service Employees International Union, are forming a new organization to challenge the old guard, the AFL-CIO. Anna Berger chairs the new labor group that's called Change to Win. Anna, first of all, what do you think about these changes in the Gulf regarding undocumented workers and lower wages?
I think that the government is taking the exact wrong approach in terms of how to rebuild the Gulf Coast. I think that what we actually have to be doing is transforming the Gulf Coast. If we remember what happened when Katrina hit, the reality is the whole world saw working poor being left behind to fend for themselves as the waters rose, to live or die because they didn't have the money for car fare or bus fare to get out of town.
But, Anne, as you know, we just heard how cash-strapped the area is, and supporters of these ideas say it will enable businesses to rebuild and therefore hire workers.
I think that the idea that the government was putting out no big contracts and putting the burden on the workers to have a lower wage as opposed to putting the burden on the contractors to make sure that they were being effective and efficient is a problem. One of the approaches that our union believes that we should have is that we should really figure out a way as we approach the transformation of the Gulf Coast to take our expertise in terms of training programs for construction workers, for hospitality workers, for service workers, for healthcare workers, and actually be able to give the people from the Gulf Coast the skills that they need to be able to transform their lives, as well as rebuild the clinics, the schools, the infrastructure that needs, and the homes and the businesses that need to be rebuilt. We think that we can work with business and partner with business, the businesses from the Gulf Coast, and with the workers and the community to really change the environment so that the next time a hurricane hits the Gulf Coast, that the workers will be well-trained, will be self-sufficient, will have an infrastructure that can deal with the problems.
Well, you know, I'm wondering if this is a tricky path to navigate for Change to Win, because when it comes to the idea of waiving the documentation of workers, the thinking is that a lot of illegal immigrants are already heading to the Gulf knowing that they can get work there. And if Change to Win fights that, won't you be seen as obstructionist, especially when you're looking to get more minorities into unions?
We're not having a fight about whether the workers are documented or undocumented. We believe that there should be a decent rate of pay, and we should be focusing on also some of the people in the community so that they can actually have a sustainable wage afterwards.
How do you feel about illegal workers?
We think that we shouldn't be exploiting workers whether they're documented or undocumented. Hmm. And that we think that the approach that's being taken right now in driving down wages, in driving down standards, including health and safety protections and environmental protections, and wage protections is a wrong approach. It's really patching up the Gulf Coast as opposed to really rebuilding it and rebuilding the society so that people can have a sustainable wage.
Do you agree with the President Bush's thinking about giving illegal workers a pathway to jobs? You know, if they're here a certain amount of time, he's proposing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Many of our members are immigrant workers, many undocumented. We believe that people are here working hard every day and that we need to figure out a way of giving them a standing in our society.
We've spoken here, Anna, with Andy Stern of SEIU, Service Employees International. When the group split from the AFL-CIO, he said things were going to be different with the new organization. So now we have Change to Win. Just tick off some of the things that you feel are different.
Well, we actually we're very excited about our approach to the Gulf Coast. A number of our unions, the carpenters, the laborers, Unite Here, and our own union, all who have training programs, extensive training programs in other parts of the country for in our core industries, are partnering with our employers to set up training programs in the Gulf Coast so that we can actually provide not only decent training but pathways to a greater job opportunities in the future for the people of the Gulf Coast.
Anna Berger, who rose through the ranks of the Service Employees International Union to become secretary-treasurer of that group, is now chair of the new Federation Change to Win. Anna, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Stay with us. Chef Jacques Pepin is ahead here and now.
Thank you.
though Chef Jacques Pepin may be best known as a television celebrity and the author of over 20 books on food and cooking, he's long been involved in education. He's the dean of special programs at the French Culinary Institute of New York City and was instrumental in founding the culinary arts program at Boston University, where, by the way, we broadcast. Jacques Pepin is being honored by both Harvard and Boston Universities this week, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you, thank you. I don't know. I must be getting old. I get all those congratulatory things.
Or you get awards. You know
yeah,
you're getting
yeah,
old
yeah,
when. Well, you're certainly still as active. You've developed a course here at Boston University, The Culture and Cuisine of France Online. How do you do that?
We started doing that, Julia Child and I, 15 years ago. And the class that I was giving was an history of French food within the context of civilization literature, starting at the 16th century up to the Little Madeleine in Proust, you know, early 20th century.
So this is very, very academic.
It was, actually. In that particular class, we had no cooking at all. It was just to situate food, as I say, in the context of political situation, in the context... I mean, there is no area of study, certainly social study, who cannot be filtered through food.
I'm thinking of Let Them Eat Cake, or what was the saying, the Marie Antoinette?
Marie Antoinette, yes. I don't think she said that exactly. She said, let them eat the brioche.
But this is actually a cooking class online, so how do you do that with no smells, no taste? Is it video that you've recorded?
It is. I did two cooking demonstrations to exemplify the cuisine bourgeoise of the 19th century, and before that, the haute cuisine française. So I did two different dishes and to show the difference and explain the...
So you do the dishes.
Right.
You make the dishes. You're not cleaning the dishes. And then the students have a chance to talk to you about, engage with you online about what they've seen. Well, fascinating. You mentioned your friend and colleague and beloved Cambridge, Massachusetts resident, Julia Child.
Yes.
One of the people responsible for bringing the craze for French food to the U.S., in the 60s and 70s. Now she is sadly gone.
Yes.
You must miss her.
Certainly, I do miss her. And Julia was the first show on television. She made the cooking respectable on television as a, well, I don't know if I could say an art form, but certainly as a métier, you know, as a trade which was respectable. And also as a woman, you know, showing that a woman could do that. Because mostly people, certainly French cooking in the context of the great French chef as being strictly male, you know.
You know, they were thought of mostly as male, but they were, French chefs were French. And now, you know, there are so many chefs. Chefs can come from the barrio. They can come from Boston and go to the very top.
Absolutely.
Is the French food craze gone along with our beloved Julia?
To a certain extent, yes and no. I mean, at the French Culinary Institute in New York, we teach French cooking, certainly the French technique. And the French technique, short of Chinese, you know, Oriental cuisine, but otherwise it's about the only type of cuisine which has established certain rule, certain structure that everyone adhere to. I do cook quite different than I would have done in the 70s. However, the technique themselves does not change.
Really, no. Does not change. But do you worry, do you watch from the sidelines and see, you know, anyone can be a chef now. There's food networks and... Do you watch and think, oh, but wait, don't forget it. It all starts with the techniques from France.
It's true, but, you know, at the French Culinary Institute, as well as at BU, when I advise a student, I said, don't go into that business to, quote, become famous, because you're bound to a very serious disappointment. When I came to America, I worked at Howard Johnson for 10 years after I worked at the Pavillon in New York, and I worked with black chefs there. And all the people, American, that I knew in kitchen as chef were black. And it was interesting because at that time, on the social scale, the work of the cook was quite low at that time. And any good mother would have wanted her child to be a lawyer, a doctor, an architect, but certainly not a cook. Now we are genius. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, now they're not cooks, they're
and
chefs.
Strangely enough, now that we are genius, there is almost no more black in the profession that I knew at that time.
You're reminding me of the late African-American chef Patrick Clark, who turned down that nomination to be a White House chef for the Clintons to work at New York's Tavern on the Green.
He was really a great mentor for many young African-American chefs. unfortunately, is gone. Yes.
But you make a point. Let's get the African Americans, who were once the great cooks,
right,
to be the chefs of today. I want to talk about when you started. I'm looking at the cover of your book, The Apprentice, My Life in the Kitchen. You look so young.
Well, I am very young. I was 13 and a half, and I left home to go into apprenticeship. And I have to say that home actually was a restaurant where my mother was the chef. So as far as I can think, from 5 to 6 years old, it was somewhere in the kitchen of a restaurant helping, working. And my father was a cabinet maker by trade.
And then you, years later, are, well, cooking for the president of France, Charles de Gaulle.
That was under the Fourth Republic in France, so the government were changing at a fairly rapid pace. So I was chef under three governments, the last one being Charles de Gaulle, yes.
You have lived in the U.S.
much longer than I've lived in France.
A half a century.
Yes.
What do you think? I mean, is there, how much of you still has the soul of a French chef? I mean, obviously that will always be there, but how much of you is now eating with, you know, more American food?
This is a very speculative question. In fact, I was talking to my friend in the car coming up about my last version of the clam chowder that we used to do at Howard Johnson.
It was wonderful. And I loved the Howard Johnson's clam chowder.
And the lobster roll and the Robin sandwich and many, many other things. We have a mixture. My wife, being born in New York City, actually from a Puerto Rican mother and a Cuban father, so that makes her a real New Yorker. So we have a mix in the house, and we eat food from around the world. So I don't try, after so many years, to be French, and by the same token, I don't try not to be French. I frankly don't think in those terms anymore. I cook what I feel like eating, and it does change and follow the season and follow the taste of my guest or my family or my friend. You know?
Do you consider yourself an American?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I am an American.
I know, but you're Jacques Pepin.
Yeah, but I have been Jacques Pepin now some time.
Jacques Pepin. Well, Jacques. Here at...
My mother-in-law always called me Jacques. Remember, she was Puerto Rican, so she read Jacques.
Well, here in Boston, to pick up some of the many awards being sent your way for your work in education. And it just reminds me, coming full circle, you began cooking when you were 13, and you had to stop a formal education, picked it up when you came to the States, with only a few phrases of English, but it went on to get your bachelor's, your master's, even considered a PhD. Obviously, that's important to you.
It's interesting that you said that. I was at Columbia University, and I proposed a doctoral dissertation on an history of French food within the context of civilization literature. And 1968, I basically finished most of the requirement for the PhD, and I had to write my thesis, which was refused. They told me, "Are you crazy about food?" You know. And this is actually the class we are teaching at BU here.
The world catches up with Jacques Pepin, or what did you say, Jacques? What is your
Jacques?
Jacques. Jacques Pepin, chef, teacher, a television personality, food writer, and educator. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.